So it's 1965. The fashion world is, at its peak. And Yves Saint Laurent, the biggest name in French couture, sends a model down the runway.
Right.
Now, you'd expect something frilly, maybe some lace, right? An intricate pattern. But this model walks out in this simple sleeveless cocktail dress.
Just a basic shift dress, really.
And the design on it just stopped everyone cold.
It was so shocking because it was so, well, so simple, aggressively
It
simple.
was stark white, and it was cut up by these thick black grid lines. And then you had these blocks of just pure bright red, yellow, and blue. It didn't even look like clothing. It looked like a painting walking toward you.
Oh, it's iconic. I mean, that look basically defined the whole mod thing in the 60s. But the fascinating thing is, Saint Laurent wasn't trying to invent something totally
It
new.
wasn't.
No, he was paying tribute to something much older, something from like 50 years before that had absolutely nothing to do with fashion.
It reminds me of those abstract paintings you see in a modern art museum, the ones where you kind of look at it and think, okay, it's a square. I could have done
That's
this.
it, exactly. That dress is a direct homage to the Distille movement and to the painter Pies Mondrian specifically. And that's what we're going to unpack today. Because while most people recognize those squares and lines, I mean, you see them on coffee mugs, on sneakers, the White Stripes album covers. Very few people realize that this wasn't just some cool graphic design choice. It was this radical, almost fanatical attempt to redesign the entire human experience.
Wow, that sounds intense for a bunch of rectangles. So, what's our mission for this deep dive?
We're going to look at how a small group of Dutch artists back in 1917 decided to strip art down to its absolute bare bones. We'll explore why they wanted to just delete nature from their work, how they tried to turn living rooms into these spiritual experiences, and the really dramatic story of how the two leaders of the movement completely destroyed their friendship over a single geometric shape.
Wait, hold on. A geometric shape, like they broke up because one of them drew a circle or something.
We will definitely get to that. It's actually, believe it or not, even more specific and more pettily philosophical than a circle. But to understand any of it, we really have to go back to 1917.
1917, World War I is raging.
The world is on fire. I mean, Europe is in total chaos. You've got the trenches, the mustard gas, just this senseless destruction of millions of lives. And you have to put yourself in the mindset of an artist seeing all this. They're looking at the old world, the world of Victorian excess, of nationalism, of individualism, of all these messy, chaotic emotions. And they're thinking this is what caused the catastrophe.
So they're blaming the messiness of the culture for the war itself.
In a way, yeah. They really felt the old way of building society had just failed. So this group in the Netherlands, which was neutral during the war, by the way, so they were kind of on this island of calm, looking out at the storm, they decided they needed to hit the reset button. They didn't just want to paint pretty pictures. They wanted to rebuild the spiritual fabric of society using order, using harmony.
And that's Distille.
Distille, which it literally just means the style.
The style. That sounds a little arrogant, doesn't it? Not a style, but the
And
style.
one and only.
So, who are the main characters in this story?
The key figures are Theo van Doesburg. You should think of him as the agitator, the hype man, the one publishing the magazine and getting everyone on board. Then you have Piet Mondrian, who's the spiritual leader, the painter. And you also have Gerrit Rietveld, an architect and furniture maker, and a few others. But really, Mondrian and van Doesburg are the core duo. And their goal was to wipe the slate clean, to strip away what they called natural forms.
Natural forms, meaning trees,
Yeah.
cows, landscapes.
Anything that was accidental, anything individual. They believed nature is messy, a tree is crooked, a cloud is random. They were looking for the immutable core of reality. And they developed this philosophy they called neoplasticism.
Neoplasticism. That sounds like a manufacturing process for, I don't know, Tupperware.
It does. It sounds so industrial. But plastic in this context meant the plastic arts shaping, sculpting form. For them, it was deeply spiritual. And this is the part people usually miss. Mondrian wasn't just a math nerd, he was a mystic. He was a member of the Theosophical Society.
I've heard that term theosophy, but I have no idea what it actually means. Is that a religion?
It was this really popular esoteric movement around the turn of the century. You can think of it as a blend of Eastern philosophy, mysticism, and a kind of science. Theosophists believed there is a hidden divine geometry underlying the entire universe. They thought the visible world, the world of appearances, was just an illusion, a veil. And if you could just peel back that veil, you'd find this universal harmony.
So Mondrian is looking at a tree and he's thinking, The bark, the leaves, that's all just distraction. I need to find the math underneath the tree.
Precisely. He was really influenced by a philosopher named Schoenmakers, who wrote about plastic mathematics. The core idea was that reality is built on opposing forces, vertical versus horizontal.
Like standing up and lying down.
Think bigger. The vertical line represented the active, the male, the spiritual, the sun. The horizontal line was the passive, the female, the material, the earth. And the whole point of art was to bring these forces into a perfect equilibrium.
That seems like a lot of pressure to put on a single canvas.
It was. And that's why the rules were so incredibly strict. If you want to reveal universal truth, you can't just do whatever you feel like. Rule number one, only straight lines, horizontal and vertical. No diagonals, no curves.
Because curves are too, what, natural, emotional?
Curves represent emotion, softness. The grid represents truth. Rule number two, only primary colors, red, yellow, blue. They saw these as the building blocks of all other colors, and you could use the non-colors, black, white, and gray.
So if Mondrian wanted to paint, say, a green apple, he literally couldn't.
He wouldn't want to. To him, painting a specific green apple is just an anecdote. Here's a fruit I saw one time. He wanted to paint the universal truth of tension and balance. He was trying to capture the source code of the universe.
It sounds incredibly rigid, like we are going to liberate humanity, but you have to follow these three extremely specific rules.
Well, that's the paradox of utopias, right?
Yeah.
To create freedom, they often impose this very strict order. And they didn't want this to just stay in art galleries. De Stijl was meant to be a Gesamtkunstwerk, a total work of art. They wanted this geometry to eat the world. They wanted it in your city, your house, your kitchen.
Which brings us to the furniture. I have definitely seen the famous red and blue chair by Gerrit Rietveld. You know the one? It looks like a bunch of wooden slats painted black with a red back and a blue seat.
That's the one.
I have to be honest. It looks wildly uncomfortable. It looks like a torture device for your lower back.
Certainly not a recliner. Rietveld designed the prototype around 1918. And you're not wrong about the comfort. But that was on purpose. Rietveld famously said, sitting is a verb.
Sitting is a verb. I thought sitting was the break you take from doing verbs.
Not for De Stijl. He didn't want you to retire into a chair and just melt away. He wanted you to be spiritually aware, physically conscious, even while you were sitting. The chair is designed to keep you alert.
Welcome home, honey. Here, sit in the chair of spiritual alertness. I feel like I'd just want a beanbag chair after a long day.
But look at the design of it. The back doesn't actually touch the seat. The arms don't really close off the sides. It emphasizes space flowing through the object. It's about continuity, not containment. They didn't want to box you in.
Speaking of not boxing people in, we have to talk about the house. The Rietveld Schroeder House.
Oh, a masterpiece. Built in 1924 for Trua Schroeder Schroeder. She was a widow, a very forward-thinking woman, and she basically commissioned Rietveld to build her a house that had no walls.
No walls. So what? Everyone just hangs out in one giant room. What if you're cooking fish? What if you want to go to sleep?
Well, flexible walls. The top floor is this big open zone. But it has these sliding partitions, so you can close them to create bedrooms, or you can open them all up to have one massive living space. It's a house of options. But the look of it, have you seen pictures of the outside?
Yeah, it looks totally bizarre. You've got these traditional Dutch brick row houses, very brown, very normal. And then just stuck on the end is this explosion of white planes and yellow bars. It looks like a painting just blew up and someone decided to live in the debris.
That's like an anti-box.
Yeah.
It just breaks open the whole concept of a house. And inside, it was the same philosophy. Mondrian, even though he didn't build houses, he took this interior design thing very seriously. He treated his own studios like 3D paintings.
How did he do that? Did he just paint the walls?
He actually used cardboard rectangles painted in primary colors.
Right.
Red, gray, yellow. And he would pin them to the white walls. And he would just obsessively rearrange them. If he felt the rhythm of the room was off, he'd move a red square, 2 inches to the left.
So he was literally living inside his own art.
Completely. He believed an interior should be just colored and colorless planes. Furniture was just this necessary evil that kind of disrupted the lines. There's a funny story that when he had guests over, if there was a flower or regular painting in the room, he'd turn it to face the wall so it wouldn't mess up the spiritual harmony.
That is dedication. Sorry, your portrait is too curvy. It's messing up my vibe.
But this dedication, this absolute refusal to compromise, it's also what eventually tore the group apart. Which brings us to the breakup.
Ah, the drama. You said before they fell out over a shape.
The Great Schism. It all happened around 1924 and 1925. The tension was building between the two leaders, Mondrian, the monk-like purist, and Van Doesburg, the restless innovator. Von Doesburg started to feel that the vertical and horizontal grid was becoming, well, a trap.
He got bored of squares.
He felt it was too static. The 1920s were roaring at this point. You had jazz, cinema, fast cars, airplanes. The world was dynamic, and Von Doesburg wanted the art to reflect that energy. So he introduced the diagonal line.
And tilted the grid?
He tilted the whole grid 45 degrees. He called this new theory elementarism, and he argued that the diagonal expressed dynamism, movement, the modern spirit.
And I'm guessing Mondrian was not a fan.
Mondrian was furious. He called the diagonal artistic heresy. You have to remember, for him, the vertical and horizontal weren't just lines. They were the immutable laws of the universe.
Yeah.
To introduce a diagonal was to introduce instability. It disrupted the spiritual peace.
So he didn't just see a tilted line. He saw chaos creeping back into the system.
That's exactly it. He felt Von Doesburg was betraying the entire mission of bringing order to the world. So Mondrian basically said, if you're going to use diagonals, I'm out. And he left the group. He seceded from Distill.
That is just unbelievable. Imagine ending a decade-long partnership because your friend drew a line at a slant.
It just shows how high the stakes were for them. I mean, this wasn't a hobby. It was religion. But Von Doesburg went on to prove his point. He designed the interior of the Café Obet in Strasbourg, which is basically the anti-Mondrian cathedral.
What was it like?
It was a nightclub and a cinema complex. Von Doesburg covered the walls, the ceilings, everything in these massive diagonal colored reliefs. When you look at the photos, it's completely disorienting. The lines just slice across the corners of the room. He said he wanted to dismantle the confines of the space.
It sounds like he wanted the room itself to dance with the people in it.
Precisely. It was kinetic. Mm-hmm. Mondrian wanted a chapel of silence. Von Doesburg wanted a dance floor of pure energy.
It's kind of sad, though. They started this utopian brotherhood to fix the world, and they couldn't even agree on the layout.
It is sad. But the irony is, after Mondrian left, his own work actually became much more dynamic, even without using the diagonal.
Right. Let's talk about Mondrian's evolution, because when people think of him, they just picture that one famous style. But he didn't start there.
Not at all. He started out painting landscapes, windmills, trees, moonlight. But if you look at a series of his paintings from around 1908 to 1913, you can see the change happening in real time. It takes a gray tree. In the first version, it looks like a tree. In the next, the branches are just simplified into arcs. In the next, the tree is just a shattering of black lines.
He's slowly dissolving the object itself.
He called it the destruction of natural appearance. He wanted to destroy volume and space to get to the truth underneath. There's a painting called Pier and Ocean. You can't see any water. You just see this rhythm of little plus signs and dashes. He's painting the movement of the ocean, not the look of the water.
And then he hits that classic grid style. But my favorite era of his is actually the very end, the New York years.
Yes. Mondrian moves to New York City in 1940 to escape World War II. Mm. He's in his late 60s. And the city just completely re-energizes him.
And his paintings change. The thick black lines, which were his signature, they disappear, right?
They do. In New York, he starts using colored lines, yellow, red, blue lines, all intersecting. And then in his final works, like Broadway Boogie Woogie, the lines themselves are broken up into these little blinking blocks of color.
It looks like a Pac-Man level.
Yeah.
Or, you know, a city grid with traffic lights blinking.
It's the rhythm of the city. Mondrian was a huge jazz fan. He loved the syncopation of boogie woogie music. He famously said that the destruction of melody in jazz was exactly what he was trying to do in his painting.
So Broadway Boogie Woogie isn't about static peace anymore. It's pulsing.
It's dynamic rhythm. He finally found that dynamism that Von Doesburg wanted, but he did it on his own terms. No diagonals required. Just the frantic electric pulse of Manhattan.
I just love that image of this very stiff, spiritual Dutch guy in a suit listening to loud jazz in Manhattan and painting these vibrant, happy squares.
It's a beautiful final act. And that vibrant energy is exactly why Yves Saint Laurent picked up on it 20 years later.
Right, bringing it all back to the dress. So Saint Laurent sees this modernity, this rhythm, and he puts it on a model. But you said earlier there was a detail about how the dress was made that really matters.
Yes. If you or I bought a Mondrian t-shirt today, it would just be a print on cotton.
Yeah.
But Saint Laurent didn't print those dresses. He constructed them.
What do you mean by that?
The dress was made of jersey.
Yeah.
And he literally cut a square of red fabric, a square of white fabric, and strips of black fabric, and then sewed them all together like a jigsaw puzzle. The grid wasn't decoration on top of the dress.
Mm-hmm.
The grid was the structure of the dress.
Oh, that's really cool. So he was actually being true to the philosophy. The structure is the art.
Exactly. He hid all the seams so it looked like one seamless piece, but it was structurally honest. And that moment in 1965 it democratized the steel.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly, this high-minded spiritual philosophy wasn't just for intellectuals anymore. It was for cool girls in London and Paris. It became pop culture.
And it feels like it never really left. I mean, you can see the ripple effects of it everywhere.
Everywhere. The Bauhaus movement took de Stijl's aesthetic and applied it to industrial mass production. And that leads directly to the international style of architecture. You know, those glass and steel skyscrapers you see in every major city. They owe a huge debt to Mondrian's ideas about planes and grids.
Even in graphic design.
Oh, huge. I mean, if you look at a website today, what is it? It's a grid, headers, sidebars, blocks of content. That clean, functional layout was pioneered by distilled artists. And of course, you've got bands like the White Stripes. Jack White was obsessed with distilled. He even named an album after it.
So we're completely surrounded by it. But I have to ask, did they succeed?
In what sense?
Well, their mission wasn't just to make cool buildings or nice dresses. Their mission was to create a universal harmony that would, you know, stop wars and make people spiritually whole. And looking around at the world today, we have the glass buildings, we have the IKEA furniture with the clean lines, we have the grid. But do he have the peace?
That's the tragic question, isn't it? Mondrian had this belief that art should eventually just dissolve into life. He thought that once we created a perfectly harmonious environment, perfect cities, perfect homes, perfect spoons, we wouldn't need paintings anymore. We wouldn't need art because we'd be living inside of it.
The death of art through its own success.
And in a way, we kind of got the aesthetic without the ethic. We took the style, and we applied it to everything. But we sort of left the spiritual quest behind. We live in the grid. But I'm not so sure we found the universal truth they were looking for.
We got the cool chair, but we're still stressed out while sitting in it.
Exactly.
Well, that is definitely something to think about next time you see a primary color block on a pair of socks. Was it a failed utopia, or did they actually succeed in designing the modern world?
Maybe a bit of both.
Thanks for diving in with us. We'll catch you on the next one.